Would you turn with me, please, to 2 Kings chapter 4. And welcome to you who are on the webcast and to our visitors that are with us today. Welcome, and I'm glad you could join us. There is a man famous in biblical stories, Elisha. And starting with verse 8, we have one of the stories from his life. It fell on a day that Elisha passed to Shunem, where there was a great woman, a woman of renown, of ability. And she asked him to eat bread, and so it was that as often as he passed by, he turned in there to eat bread. And she said to her husband, "I perceive that this is a holy man of God. He passes by here all the time. Let us make a little chamber, a little bedroom, there on the wall, and let us set for him there a bed, a table, and a stool, a candlestick, and it shall be when he comes to us that he shall turn in there." And it fell on a day that he came there, and he turned into the chamber, and there he got his rest. And he said to his servant, "Gehazi, call the Shunammite." And when he had called her, and she was there, he said, "You know, you have cared for us very kindly with all this care. What can I do for you? Would you like me to speak to the king or to the captain? Are there things in the city that would be helpful?" And she answered, "No, I dwell among my own people. Everything's fine." And he said, "What then is it that I could do for her?" And Gehazi had an idea and said, "She's no child. Her husband's old." And he said, "Call her." And when he had called her, she stood in the door. And he said, "About this season, according to the time of life, you will embrace a son." So he promises this woman of renown in the community that she's going to have a child. And she says, "Nah, my lord, you man of God, don't tease me this way." But the woman conceived and had a son in the season, in other words, after the 9 months, just as Elisha had told her, according to the time of life. And when the child was grown, it fell on a day that he went out to his father with the reapers. And he said to his father, "My head, my head." And he said, "Come, my lad." And he carried him to his mother. And when he had been taken him, she brought him in. He sat on her knees till noon, and then died. And she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God, shut the door upon him, and he went out. She went out, and she called to the husband and said, "Send me, I ask you, one of the young men with one of the asses, that I may run to the man of God and come again." He said, "What do you want him to do today? It's not a new moon nor a Sabbath. There's nothing he can do." And she says, "Well, something's going to happen good." So she saddled up the animal and said to her servant, "Drive and go forward. Slack not the riding for me, except I asked you." So she went and came into the Mount of God, Mount Carmel. And it came to pass, when the man of God saw her, he said to his servant, "Gehazi, yonder, that's the Shunammite woman. Run and ask her what she has need of. Meet her. And ask her if everything's well with her. Is it well with her husband? Is it well with her child?" And she responded, "It is well." And when she came to the man of God to the hill, she caught him by the feet, and Gehazi came near to thrust her away. But the man of God said, "Let her alone, for her soul is vexed within her. And the Lord has hid it from me. I don't know why she's so troubled." Then she said, "Did I desire a son of you? Did I not say, 'Don't deceive me and tease me'?" Then he said to Gehazi, having then figured it out, "Get on your clothes, take my staff in your hand, go the way, and if any man says anything to you, just keep on going, and lay my staff upon the face of the child." And the woman of the child, or the mother of the child, said, "As the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you." And he rose and followed her, and Gehazi passed on before him, and he laid the staff upon the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. And he went again the second time to meet him and told him and said, "The child is not awake." And when Elijah was come into the house, behold, the child was dead, and he laid upon his bed. And he went in, therefore, and shut the door upon the two of them, and prayed to God. And he went up, and laid upon the child, and put his mouth on mouth, eyes on eyes, hands on hands, stretched himself over the child. The flesh of the child became warm. Then he returned and walked in the house to and fro, and went up and stretched himself upon him. And the child sneezed seven times. And then he opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and said, "Call the Shunammite." So he called her. And when she was come in to him, he said, "Take up your son, embrace him." And the child was given his life anew. She went in at his feet. He bowed herself to the ground and took up the son and went out. This is a beautiful story. There's a little tradition about it that is wrapped up in the word embrace. She embraced her son when he was delivered of her, when he was just that young infant, and she held him because she had no child. And when life was taken from him and he died from something like a sunstroke, because he's saying, "My head, my head," eventually dying and then life given back to him, she hugs him again. Now it is said by tradition that this young lad grew to be a man known as Habakkuk. Habakkuk. And we're going to study Habakkuk today because it gives us the momentum and the motivation to make sure we stay pure before God. We're living in a dying age, and we will not die with it. We want our church to embrace us. We want our Christ to embrace us. And so it is with that motivation that I speak to you today. Habakkuk preached to the house of Judah. Habakkuk means to embrace. The double K in Habakkuk is to give us a sense of two hugs, two embraces. That's why the double K. I spoke recently on the subject of the Sabbath and explained the double B in Sabbaton. It's along the same linguistic condition that you understand the double K in Habakkuk. The heart of Habakkuk is torn, and we see in the first verse of the small three-chapter book, Nahum then Habakkuk, the burden which Habakkuk the prophet did see. Burden is a kind word for curse. The curses he saw coming to his people, for which he was a prophet, to tell them all of the difficult things that they were going to go through because they were a sinning people. And it is important for us to see the same perspective as we grow towards the age of God, and this age of man finds its soon, prayerfully soon, destruction and end. And so this man, Habakkuk, gives us, and he says, "O Lord," and this is then a conversation between Habakkuk talking to God and then God responding to Habakkuk. "O Lord, how long shall I cry and you will not hear? Even cry out unto you of the violence and you do not save." How often have I been going to just watch this tumbling nation fall off its understanding of your word and fall away? Why do you show me iniquity and cause me to behold grievance? Why do I see all this sin? And then I see what the sin births. And the people and this whole nation just keep tumbling down the wrong road. They're spoiling and violence ever before me, and they are those that raise up strife and enjoy contention. This is a Jewish commentary, and I'm brought along from the set the book on the of the 14 volumes, the one on the Minor Prophets. And the commenter says on these thoughts, there is this anomaly of a just God allowing guilt to go unchecked. Now, if you look around society today, it's easy to behold that very thing. Society as a whole is corrupt, and God isn't challenging it. It seems that the corrupt can do more dirt and still get ahead. And you faithfully obey God, keep His ways, His instructions, and it doesn't seem to pan out that you're blessed. Why is that incongruity there? And that's what Habakkuk is saying. The law is slacked. Judgment does never go forth. The wicked do compass about the righteous, therefore wrong judgment proceeds. In the recent months, we've had trials and an ongoing trial just down the road some in Orlando over the issue of who murdered whom. And it seems the way to justice is to buy the most expensive lawyer. You can go way back to days gone by, years gone by. And that's how our nation uses law. You find an attorney who knows the loopholes and can parade himself in such a way as to lure and bring the justice that should come away from justice and find the jury in the palm of his hands as he works with man. Nothing has changed. So as this man writes about what was going on in his day and age, we find the repetition happening today. Yes, this is a historical book, but when we're finally done, I'm going to show you that it is a book upon a book. It is an overlay for us to understand, and this in time. It isn't just a history book of days gone by and centuries ago. It is for us also to take our clear warning, because the law is slack today. So we find now in verse 5, and maybe your Bible will have a paragraph signal, a sign, a double-stroked P backwards. And that's then the start of the remark or reply from our Maker. He says, "Behold you among the heathen." And this has to be the way it is. We have to be separate from the heathen. We cannot be with them or part of them. "Regard and wonder marvelously, for I will work a work in your days which you will not believe, though it be told you." Something's going to happen that's stranger than fiction. "I will raise up the Chaldeans." In other words, the Babylonians. The Assyrians had already been through the land. They had taken the house of Israel captive. And now this man is saying the house of Judah is going to fall victim to the Babylonians, the Chaldeans. "They're a bitter and hasty nation." In other words, they have a lot of bite and they don't think about much about what they're doing and consider, is there something else to do? They just take the first notion and they grab and they bite. "Who march through the breadth of the land to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs? For they're a terrible and dreadful." God says their judgment and their dignity precedes them. And so out in front of them, they have a reputation. And we need to know that there are peoples on the face of the earth today that have a reputation for anarchy and destruction. Their horses are swifter than the leopards. They're more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen shall spread themselves, and their horsemen shall come from far. They'll fly as an eagle that hastens to eat. The word eagle can otherwise be translated to other types of birds that would pillage and take of prey. Hawks would be a type of that. Other types of birds of that kind. It's an interesting thing I found years ago when I was traveling and learning and drinking the amount of beer that a young boy will enjoy. There's a beer in Israel, and it's called Nesher. And the word that is translated here, eagle, is the same word, Nesher. And when you think about it, it was fun for us at the time. I was working in Israel and enjoying the opportunities, and we sometimes would go to a movie. There was only one movie playing, and I forget which Disney one it was, but it's where those rabbits get all twitter-pated and they're bouncing up and down in love. I forget if it was Snow White or Alice in Wonderland or which one, but it was a child movie, and that's the only thing we could find in Jerusalem week upon week upon week. And the saying in the movie was that the rabbits got twitter-pated. And so we played with it a bit and decided that they really got Nesher-pated, thinking of the beer. But here is this very cruel bird taking captive in a hawkish way, ripping at the meat, flying and taking whatever they want. 9, for they shall come all for violence. Their faces shall sup up as the east wind, and they shall gather the captivity as the sand. And they shall scoff at the kings, and the princes shall be a scorn to them. They shall deride every stronghold. So these Chaldeans cannot be stopped. They can't be detoured. They can't be argued with. They will not move off their track. They'll heap dust and take it. Then shall his mind change, and he shall pass over and offend, imputing that his power is from his God. Now there are some things that can be further studied from parts of verse 11, but basically, for our use today, they're arrogant, and they give Baal, their god, small g, the credit for what is their success. And so now we have the response in another paragraph break from Habakkuk, and he says, "Are not you forever everlasting, O my God? You're my Holy One. We shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them for judgment. You're going to take care of them. But why is this all happening? Why are our nations prophesied to be destroyed in such an ugly way? Almighty God, you have established them for correction." And so again, it's this confusion that happens when you see the marauding peoples seemingly have the upper hand and taking advantage of those that are close to God. Or seemingly so, because they say they're a nation of Christians. Yes, we are a nation of Christians. Sea to shining sea, from shore to shore. The problem is it's only a quarter inch thick. Our Christianity does not go anywhere. And yours and mine has to go down 6 feet and be stable in the grave. It has to be one that we will die for. And most Americans won't die for what they think they believe. But you, God, are of purer eyes than to behold evil. You cannot look on iniquity. Wherefore Look you upon them that deal treacherously. Remember when Christ died and it said that God turned his head and would not look upon his son who had become the sole recipient of all that is sin and evil? And he was then forlorn and forgotten, and at that point represented sin for all mankind. God will not put himself in the presence of sin. You hold your tongue when the wicked devours the man that is more righteous than he. Why don't you say something, God? You make men as the fishes of the sea and the creeping things that have no ruler over them. They take up all of them with the angle or the fish hook. You catch them in their net and gather them in your other net. Therefore they rejoice and are glad. So they sacrifice to their net, and they think Baal has given them their success because they've thrown their net over the armies of the land and taken them captive, and they think that their God has given that to them. So they burn incense to their net, because by their portion is fat and their meat plenteous. Shall they therefore empty their net and not spare continually to slay the nations? And here's a man whose heart is just filled with seeing the travesty that's going on with these marauding peoples. And it's remembering for us then, if we go back to Ezekiel chapter 9, beginning with verse 3. And the glory of the God of Israel was gone up from the cherub, whereupon he was to the threshold at the house, and he called to the man clothed with white linen, which had the writer's inkhorn by his side. And the Lord said unto him, Go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, set a mark upon the foreheads of the men that sigh and that cry, for all the abominations that be done in the midst thereof. It is very important that we be a sighing and crying people, that we know what is wrong in our land, just as Habakkuk knew what was wrong as he looked over the horizons. It's very important for us to know what abominations and sins are done in the larger society around us. They should be enormously important to us, for us to know what is wrong, for us to be so close to the ways of God and His instructions that we know what is wrong when we cast our eyes upon the newspaper, upon the whatever media we might be looking at. I'll turn back from Ezekiel 9 for just a moment into Revelation, adding a couple of scriptures that come into the context of setting a mark upon those. In Revelation 12:13, and when the dragon, Satan, saw that he was cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who brought forth the man-child. He persecuted then the church. And she was then given her place of safety, and she might fly to there, where she's nourished for 3.5 times. Now the serpent, who is Satan, and you can see that from verse 9, cast out of his mouth water as a flood, in fact then armies, after the woman, after the church, that he might cause her to be carried away. And the earth, though, helped her out and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out. And the dragon was mad with the woman and went to make war with the remnant of her seed. Satan does not want our success. These are the ones who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Across the page in chapter 14. And I looked, and lo, the Lamb stood on the Mount Zion with him 144,000, having his Father's name written in their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, as the voice of many waters and as the voice of great thunder. And I heard the voice of harpers harping with their harps, And they sung, as it were, a new song before the throne, before the four beasts and the elders, and no man could learn that song but the 144,000 that were redeemed from the earth, that were bought from the earth. And so this story goes on, and it says in verse 4, they were redeemed from among men, being the first fruits unto God and to the Lamb, and in their mouth was found no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. These are unique individuals, and God says that in Ezekiel 9:4 that He has set His mark upon His people. And so there are these other scriptures, and there's other things that you can turn to in this thought package to help you understand that God's way is understood so deeply by some, and He has such a relationship with them that they are marked by Him. And that mark is His Holy Spirit. It isn't anything physical. It isn't something that's a third ear growing out of the top of your head or something like that. It's indeed a relationship. And He says these ones sigh and cry. And so when we go back to Ezekiel 9, verse 5, and to the others He said in My hearing, go you after Him through the city and smite, and let not your eye spare, neither have pity. Slay old and young, maids and little children and women, but come not near any man upon whom is the mark. And begin at My sanctuary. Where is God's sanctuary? Where does God sanction His presence? Where have we asked for His presence today? Here. Starting with us. Then they began at the ancient men which were before the house. He said, defile the house and fill the courts with the slain. Go forth, and they went forth and slew in this city. And so Ezekiel has the same complex. And he says, it came to pass while they were slaying them that I was left. And so evidently I've got the mark. I understand the ways of the world are not right. And I cried and said, God, why will you destroy all the rest of Israel and you're pouring out of your fury upon Jerusalem? Why all this destruction? Why must I see it? And he said unto me, the iniquities of the house of Israel and Judah is exceedingly great, and the land full of blood and the city full of perverseness. For they said, the Lord has forsaken the earth and the Lord doesn't care. As you read that word perverse, other translations have other words sometimes. But something that is perverted, that is twisted, our first thought goes to how people have tested the waters and twisted sexuality. And when you think of those things, I don't think your mind immediately comes to the thought, well, that's going to be okay. God can accept that. God does see it. And so whatever is perverse or twisted that is away from God, He will not put up with. So 10, and as for Me also, My eye shall not spare, neither will I have pity, but I will recompense their way upon their head. Behold, the man clothed with linen, which had the inkhorn by his stand, reported the matter, saying, I have done all that You have commanded me. So in our thinking through of these things, do we sigh and cry then for the problems that we see around us like Habakkuk did? It's good that we mourn over all the corruption and wickedness and abominations that are happening in this land. If you can have that attitude, it tells God something about your heart, what is made up in here. That in all of it you're seeing and considering, you're repulsed by that which is sin. God has to know that you clearly are against and will not put up with sin, and that you'll make sure that your life is changed in sinless. And so he sets them apart, those that sigh and cry, because he sees their heart. He sees the character of those like Habakkuk who would not endure to watch that go on. Yet all the while we do endure it. Luke 21:19 says, "In patience, possess your souls." Well, as you think, you know, it's a hard walk sometimes, and you have to do it patiently. You have to walk step by step, but you have these enduring opportunities. And some of the things that you have to step away from are difficult to understand in your beginnings of walking the walk with these ways. You don't know how to react, and as the understanding of how Christ would react comes to you, it gives you that opportunity. You ask yourselves, how do you react when you see what's happening to our nation? How do you react when you see the sex and violence and these things on our media, in books, billboards, television? How do you react to terrorism and to terrorists? What's your perspective that you see in that ugly head that is called the Arab Spring? How do you react to the problems of our society with drug use and abuse, oppression? How do you put your thoughts together around the court systems that we have, that God allows so much injustice to stand? Well, sometimes we become numb and hardened, and we really don't want to think about what's wrong. We want to push it aside. It's difficult to push aside. We must come to the reality of sighing and crying over the depths of the depravity of our nation. Now in Habakkuk 2, the story continues. Habakkuk says, "I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower, and I will watch to see what he will say to me and what I shall answer when I am reproved." He's going to take a stand and do his own watching. Now, proverbially, we'll put the subject of watching, as is covered in Ezekiel 33 and 34, to something that the church does. What do you personally watch? What are you watching? Are you watching after your life? And so the reply from the Lord is, "Write the vision and make it plain upon tables, that he may run that reads it." Make it so clear what you write down, that the person who starts to read it says, "Boy, I'm getting out of here right now. I'm going to run." Just like it talks of in Corinthians, that we should make sure that we have nothing to do with fornication. Flee fornication. Hebrews 12 talks to us about run with race, with patience, the race set before us. When we look at our life, running has to be part of it. He tells us there's going to be some things that you should read, and if your heart will understand them, they're so clear that you know you don't want to have anything to do with them, and you're going to turn around and go the other way. Now notice verse 3. "For the vision is yet for an appointed time." So what we are reading here today has its application historically to the people of the house of Judah. But there is another time coming, appointed time, at the end it shall speak. Not halfway there, not at the beginning. There's some appointed time at the end. And so that is one of the ways that we know the duality of this book, that it applies not only today, but applies at a time to come, which I personally feel is closer than it was yesterday. This world can't survive much longer. "Behold, the soul..." Well, I didn't finish 3. "Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. It's not going to be stopped. The appointed time will come. His soul, which is lifted up, is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. The just shall live by his faith. Now, if you are familiar with the Bible, those are familiar words. Paul used them three times. Romans 1:17, he said, the just shall live by faith. When the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. It's also mentioned by Paul in Galatians 3:11. No man is justified by the law in the sight of God. It is evident, for the just shall live by faith. And it's mentioned in Hebrews 10:38. Now the just shall live by faith, but if any man draws back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him. The just shall live by faith. This commentary put it in a unique way. It's making a comment from one writer, Simley, who is recorded in the Talmud of having said, quote, Moses gave Israel 613 commandments. If you go through the writings in the Pentateuch, you'll find 613 directions given by Moses, or from God through Moses, to the peoples of Israel, telling them how they should do certain things. David reduced them to 10. And if you look at the words of David, and this has somewhat to do with canonization, because there are men like Moses, David, and so forth, who canonized the Bible. That is, they took the books that were available at that time and ordered them, or put them in order, and reviewed them. And God had these seven periods of canonization, which becomes a separate study of its own. But it says, Moses gave Israel 613. David reduced the 613 to 10. And then Isaiah, he says, reduced it to 2. And Christ talks about that. You should love God first, and then love your neighbor as yourself. Love God and love man. That's the 2. And then he says, but Habakkuk reduced it to 1. The just shall live by faith. Those that are justified, whose sins are forgiven, live in faith for tomorrow. And I think that's remarkable that you can look at it that way. Now we're going to go through the next verses, and I'll make some slight comment. The next verses contain 5 woes. The first one is in verse 6, the second in verse 9, the third in verse 12. I see you're writing. Okay, I'm going to start all over so you get them all. I'll go slow. The first one is in verse 6, the second in verse 9, the third in verse 12, the fourth in verse 15, and the last woe, the fifth one mentioned in the chapter, is in verse 19. And these curses are mentioned because of the way our nation and the nations of Israel, the tribes of God's people, the way we react so individually and subjectively, and trying to get everything we can for ourselves out of the life that has been given by God. So starting in verse 6, shall not all these take up a parable against him, and a taunting proverb against him, and say, woe, or cursed is him that increases that which is not his. People that are involved with taking and finding some way to work the system so they can have. They want to be consuming to the best of their ability. How long? And to him that lays himself on thick clay. And this is a way of life that just sticks too much, so much to them. It's like walking through thick clay. You know, when you're walking through mud and how difficult it is to bring up one foot and put it down. I was watching a little short comedic thing on, it was about 15 seconds worth on my computer this week. It popped up, and so I looked at it. And here's a young girl, and she's walking through the yard after it had rained, and the mud was about a foot thick. And she's picking up one foot, walking carefully. She didn't want to get any more mud on her than possible. She had her clothes on, and she was trying to keep them clean. And she was just trying to get through the mud, just in her bare feet, I think it was, so she wouldn't get anything else dirty. And she's walking, and she's walking, and she's walking, and she's making slow but steady progress. And then the mud comes alive. And her brother, who had covered himself in mud, was laying in there just waiting with eyes up. Everything else was mudded. And when she comes by, he pops up out of the mud pile and chases her, and she falls and gets herself all muddy. Well, that's how it is. It says it sticks to yourself like thick clay. People that do these kinds of things, that take what isn't theirs, it's like something they just got to habitually do. They do it more and more and more. Shall they not rise up suddenly? Shall they not bite you and awake that shall vex thee? And they shall be for booties to them. Who's going to have all these things? Who's going to enjoy all the things that they've consumed by their theft and fraud? 2 billion. 2 billion disappeared this week. Bank Swiss. 2 billion. Where did it go? The bank's in the red for the next 3 months. Who can consume that kind of money? Was it just bad trading, or was it trading with some other motive? The third, or verse 2, a second, verse 9, the second will. Woe to him that covers an evil. Woe to him that covets an evil covetousness to his house, that he may set his nest on high, that he may be delivered from the power of evil. These have consulted shame to your house by cutting off many people and have sinned against your life or your soul. For the stone shall cry out of the wall, and the beam out of the timber shall answer it. So there's this covetousness. They wanted everything, tried to take everything. And that's the way of a lot of the politicians, or so it is that they might be kindly called, that around this earth, the people that rule in North Korea, the people that rule in the African states, the tens of thousands that are starving to death because their foodstuffs will not be delivered to them and probably then sold on the black market. They covet to have everything. This kind of perverseness, depravity, was alive then, and it has not changed. It is still today. The third one in 12. Cursed is him that hides that builds a town with blood and establishes a city by iniquity. Behold, is it not of the Lord of hosts that the people shall labor in the very fire, and the people shall weary themselves for very vanity? And so the people that take possession, spilling blood, like what's going on in the Middle East right now, the Palestinians and the Israelis and the wars that continue, It's just an amazing thing to see the theft taking by spilling blood. But then we have an anomaly here in verse 14. For the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. That's when all these things are going to stop. There's the interjection of a single thought that this is only going to change under the mighty hand of the returning Christ. So then we go to the fourth woe in 15. Woe to him that gives his neighbor drink, that puts the bottle to him and makes him drunk so that he can look on his nakedness. You're filled with shame for glory. Drink you also and let the foreskin be uncovered. Now the cup of the Lord's right hand shall be turned to you, and shameful spewing shall be on your glory. Here it talks about the insatiable appetites once again, this time in a literal sense of drink. And if your eye will cast upon the verse 15 and see the word bottle, as compared in verse 16, the word cup. Some people drink it by the bottle. The Lord has a cup. And there have been people looking for that cup for ages, but don't think they'll find it. The golden chalice. But it talks about there's a matter of modesty here. And so many people get so drunk that, in fact, clothing has no apparent usefulness. And they do things that are very shameful, uncovering their sex organs. Making story of their nudity, like a congressman named Wiener. That's our leadership today. And we have to be so different from that. So clearly different. And then we come to the fifth woe. I'll start in 18. What profits the graven image that the maker of it has graven it? The molten image that a teacher of lies, the maker of his work, trusts therein to make idols. Woe to him that says to the wood, awake, to the dumb stone, arise, it shall teach. And so idolatry says this is one of the ways that we're going to be finding ourselves cursed because of our idolatry. Is laid over with gold and silver, there's no breath at all in the midst of it. Idolatry, worshiping trees and stones. And we worship a lot of things in today. And what is the worship that we find in our nation that is really a profitable and good worship? At this day and age, we're trying to take surveys of worshiping our politicians. Who is worth worshiping? Who is the leader? Our nation does not talk of God. But we come to verse 20. And it's an important verse of transition. But the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before him. Now, where is the Lord in his holy temple? That's in the temple that is to come, the New Jerusalem. And there is going to be a time when there is this hush, this quiet. There is silence in heaven, silence on earth as we wait for the return and the establishment of the great throne of God and the new Jerusalem coming down from the heavens. That time is coming. And so verse 20 itself gives us another understanding of the transition that is going to take place. This is not just a historical work. This is a prophetical work. And it tells us Christ will return and eventually the throne of God will be with man. Talking of Revelation 21:1, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away. There was no more sea. That time will come. No, the Lord's place in the temple was the Holy of Holies. And this illustrates the prophecy of heavenly Jerusalem. Habakkuk is dual in nature. It applies to the rebuilding of Jerusalem at that time after the captivity, and to the time when the heavenly Jerusalem does return. And so looking at what happens when Christ returns, that is the subject matter of chapter 3. Chapter 3 is a poem. Some of you that have a New King James Version on your lap will see the poetic style. And it's one of those things that you learned when you were probably a junior in high school, and you said, okay, now I've got that one down, let's move on to something else so I can forget epic poems. As you remembered having been taught and having to read things that just didn't always make sense. At least they were boring, but things like Homer's Odyssey. I know all of you read that continually every night. It's one of your favorites, right? Well, this poem is written in that same literary style. Chapter 3 is in the style of an epic poem. Rhythm and rhyme, metering, are not typical. It isn't the Mother Goose kind of a rhyme that you might have thought of. It isn't Edgar Guest. Anybody in here know who Edgar Guest is besides me? Oh, good. There's two of us, three of us. So I want to read this third chapter. I'm going to read it out of the Moffat translation because it captures the uniqueness of the poetry. Now, you follow along in whatever translation you have, but consider this is what is going to happen to change society. Christ is going to return, and it is going to be an upheaval the likes of which the earth has never seen. So this prayer of the prophet Habakkuk in dithyrambic measure. Verse 2. We have heard you, O Eternal. We have seen you in action. Strike now, for the years are passing. The end of years is coming. This is about the end of mankind's rule. Reveal yourself now as the years go by. Amid the wrath, remember to be merciful. We all need mercy. God comes from Teman, the majestic one from Paran's hills. His splendor over all the sky, his glory filling all the earth. His radiance is a lightning blaze, on either side flash rays. And there he veils his might, but before him pestilence strides, behind him the burning plague. At his step the earth is shaken. At his look, nations are scattered. The ancient hills are scattered. Mountains of old sink low, where he marched long ago, scarring the tents of Cushan, shaking the mighty tents of Midian. Over the sea you stride with your steeds. Your mighty waters surge. Are you angry with the hills, O you Eternal? Are you wrathful at the sea, that you are storming on your steeds, upon your chariots in triumph? Your bow, the clans bound by an oath, you bear, and the land is torn with streams. The hills writhe at your sight, floods pour down from the skies. The torrents roar, the sun forgets to rise, the moon to move. Before the flashes of your darting arrows, before the sheen of your lightnings and your lance, you trample the earth in fury, threshing the peoples in your anger. You are abroad to rescue your own nation, to save your chosen. You have unroofed the enemy's house, you've laid it bare to the foundations. Your spears have pierced the warrior chiefs, who stormed out to scatter us. Their joy was to murder us. Poor folk, we are in hiding. The sound of this sets our heart a-shaking. We listen with lips a-quiver. Our very bones are breaking, and as we stand, we shiver. Yet calmly we await the day of doom that dawns upon the folk who would assail us. Though the fig tree may not blossom, though no fruit is on the vine, though the olive crop has failed, though the fields give us no food, though the folds have lost their flocks, and in the stalls no cattle lie, yet in the eternal we will find our joy. We will rejoice in the God who saved us. The Lord, the Eternal, is our strength. He made our feet sure as the feet of deer. Help us to keep our footing on the heights. That's what's ahead. And this book is telling us that there is a time of reckoning. It happened long ago to the house of Judah, and it will happen again to the peoples of these nations. Now, what are we going to do? Are we going to be like those around us, or will we be separate? Will we stand tall? If we die, will we die hearty as Christians, awaiting a resurrection? What will we do? Well, we'll do what is right. We'll live the right way to death, and hopefully not death, but to change in the moment, in the twinkling of an eye. But indeed, yes, we are among them, but we are not of them.